How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. We are also available on the internet at www.cjsf.ca. And if you want any information, you can call us at 778-782-CJSF. On this week's episode of Sustainable Futures, Ryan speaks with Val Schaefer, a professor and urban ecologist, about sustainability and urban ecology.
You know, you need to deal with people who are living as though they're planning to stay. You know, this is the key.
And Kim catches up with Andrew Appleton, manager of stewardship and restoration services, to talk about Evergreen's efforts to get city dwellers engaged in urban green spaces.
Really, we're a social organization as well as an environmental organization. We engage people in their green space. We do that through hands-on community stewardship, through educational programs.
And of course, I bring you your weekly roundup of streeters and news. Welcome to Sustainable Futures.
I'm Ryan Fletcher.
And I'm Kim Tay.
And today's program is going to be on urban ecology.
We've spoken to somebody who's actually, you know, working on the ground with a stewardship group in Jericho Park in Vancouver to maintain the green space there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also spoke with Val Schaefer, who is a professor, also very, very knowledgeable about the concept of urban ecology and the practice of it. You know, how do you actually build a livable region and a livable city? And how do you build green spaces in nature back into the city?
Yeah, I think Val's interview will work well to sort of define and give you a great overview of urban ecology, and then the green spaces interview will be sort of the hands-on, on-the-ground sort of perspective.
Yeah, so before we get to the interview, Ryan, I actually just wanted to share a couple of facts that I found, like the fact that we're delving a little bit deeper into urban ecology because so many people live in cities. Just to give you an example, according to the 2006 Canadian census, there were 25 million people living in cities, and that was the equivalent of 80% of Canadians. And this, they show, has risen steadily since 1901. So mm-hmm. for, you know, the better part of a century, more and more people have been moving into cities. And then also worldwide, according to the United Nations Population Fund, more than half of the world's population live in urban areas. And by 2030, that is expected to rise to 5 billion people living in cities. So the whole idea of urban ecology, bringing nature back into cities, is becoming increasingly important. And not just bringing nature into cities, but making a sustainable city.
It's also important because civic leaders can make decisions that have a big impact provincially because the city carries so many people. They can act with a large degree of independence from the provincial decision makers. I mean, just look at the United States and how some of the cities in the United States are fantastic, even though the country is not so good.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. First up, we have Ryan's interview with Val Schaefer.
Okay, we'll take it away. So this is Ryan Fletcher on Sustainable Futures, and I'm here with Val Schaefer, the faculty coordinator of the Restoration of Natural Systems program in the School of Environmental Studies. Welcome to the show, Val.
Thanks, Ryan.
And we're going to be talking about urban ecology today. What is urban ecology?
Well, what we're doing is we're looking at ecology within an urban context. So we're looking at plants and animals and all sorts of species and the relationships between them. And superimposed on that is the relationships that they would then have with the built environment and with human activities.
Is there an element of urban design in that?
There are a lot of design elements which have a big role to play in urban ecology. So in the work that I do, I frequently find myself working with landscape architects and urban planners. What we're looking at are things such as the size of patches of green space and how they're connected and what sort of buffers are required for them to function properly. What is happening in terms of water when it falls onto a city lot of some kind, whether or not it's allowed to infiltrate on site, which is something called low impact development, or if it's conveyed off site. These sorts of factors have big roles to play in what happens with biodiversity.
I suppose you're looking at the natural lay of the land. Would that be true?
Yeah, in the case of urban ecology, with how I treat the subject, I'm interested in anything from an individual street tree to entire watersheds. So we do look at what is the wildlife habitat value of a street tree on a boulevard. What is the value of a few trees in somebody's backyard? What is the value of a woodlot in a community? How big does a park need to be in order to be of use to species which we call urban avoiders as opposed to the urban adapters or urban exploiters? Yeah. We're interested in large parks like Stanley Park, and we're interested in the watersheds on the North Shore. You know, it covers the entire spectrum. It all depends on what question it is we're looking at, and what scale and what scope we need to evaluate that question on.
How did you get involved in urban ecology?
Well, from a couple of perspectives. One is that my early years, until I was about 8, I was growing up in Montreal, and I was basically in a bit of an urban slum, I suppose. It was very high density and very dirty. And at the age of 9, my parents moved us to a suburb called Laval. And Laval was just, it was like heaven on earth to me. So I went from seeing nothing except dirty city streets and, you know, busy traffic and noise to seeing nature. And so this sort of opened my eyes to, but it was still in the city. It was in a suburb in this case, but it was still urban. Mm-hmm. So it kind of gave me a different perspective. Over the years, I found myself always living in a city. I was either in Montreal or Toronto or Ottawa or Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And especially when I came to Vancouver, people started, well, they were talking as if nature didn't exist in the city. You know, they thought nature was something that you experienced when you went to Manning Park on the weekend, you know, or if you went up north. And I found myself arguing in defense of nature in the city, saying, well, that's not true. You know, there is nature in the city. It's all around us. And so I spent quite a bit of time documenting what forms of nature there were in the city and trying to just draw attention to the value of nature in the city and get people to appreciate its value both to wildlife and to people.
Okay. Is that an easy argument to make with somebody? Do you ever come across people that really are hard to convince of the value of that?
Initially, it was very difficult to talk about the value of nature in the city. I found there was a turning point when we were looking at creating protected areas within British Columbia. And this was shortly after our Common Future and the Gros-Brundtland report in 1987. And there was some discussion about how much habitat needed to be set aside to conserve biodiversity. Mm-hmm. And someone grabbed a number out of a hat. I don't think it was really grounded in science at all. Mm-hmm. But they said 12%. You know, that we needed 12%. And I think the province of BC set a target of putting about 12% of the land base aside for protected areas. And over the years, it became apparent that what they were doing was setting aside mountaintops and, these remote areas that, you know, people question their value in terms of biodiversity. And it sort of begged the question, well, where are these areas that have a lot of biodiversity? And it turned out it's cities. You know, a lot of cities are built in areas with high biodiversity. That's why they were put there. People wanted to take advantage of this. If we look in the case of Vancouver, for example, we're on the mouth of the Fraser River. 25% of the province is drained by the Fraser River. It's the world's largest salmon run. Every last one of the 200 million fry and smolts coming out of the system every year pass through Greater Vancouver. And every last one of the adults that go into the system to spawn are passing through Greater Vancouver. So whatever is happening in this little area is going to have an impact there. And the same is true for migrating birds. We're on the Pacific Flyway. We're a major stopover point. So birds from Alaska, birds from Russia, you know, and they're migrating down to South America and migrating back again. So these birds from three different continents are descending onto Greater Vancouver. Over the years, it became apparent that the cities are important, and Greater Vancouver especially is a very good example. So from the point of view of protected areas, that changed. The other change was in terms of people appreciating the impact of nature on their lives, on their psychology. And this came from landscape architecture and landscape architects, and in particular the work of a husband and wife team, Rachel and Stephen Kaplan, in the University of Michigan. So they talked about things such as directed attention fatigue, where people are forced to concentrate on things during the day, like you might be doing in a class that you're not particularly interested in, and you know, you're forcing yourself to pay attention because you might have to answer a question on a test from what this person's talking about. Well, it's exhausting, you know, and people do that at work as well. They have a job they may not like, and they're forcing themselves to do this. Mm-hmm. And the Kaplans are able to demonstrate that nature provided release from this type of fatigue. Mm-hmm. They also have this concept of involuntary attention fatigue, just the hustle and bustle of the city, the noise in the background, how it wears you down. And nature also provides release from that. And there was also some research in terms of recovery from health issues and hospital stays. And there was a study done in the late 1980s by a fellow called Ulrich, and he demonstrated that in the case of the surgeries at that time, the average recovery time was 9 days, but if there was a view of nature from the city, it was 8 days. Mm-hmm. So this sort of thing starts to catch the attention of a lot of people because this means money. You know, if someone's out of the hospital a day sooner than they would otherwise be, then that's important. And then very recently, with all the concern about ADD and other childhood disorders, there was a book that came out a couple of years ago called Last Child in the Woods by Richard Louvre, and he postulated this thing called nature deficit disorder. And this is something that means that we need to have nature in the lives of children, and that it's very important in terms of development, and if it's missing, then that has some consequences. So this then means that people want to see nature in the city, and they value it. So both from the point of view of biodiversity from migrating birds and fish and the implications that has for economies and people's individual psychologies and how that affects their quality of life, there's been a lot more interest about urban ecology, I think.
In transportation systems now, we're starting to talk about blacktop and parking lots and whatnot. What's a good model? What would you say might be a good model for a city's transportation system as far as the urban ecology is concerned?
Well, the biggest threat to urban systems or urban ecology is just the blacktop itself. There are air quality issues. There are issues with toxic chemicals leaching off of cars and going into storm drains. That is a problem as well. But certainly, the blacktop, or what we call impervious surface, is the one that's most disruptive. And there are different figures in terms of watersheds and what we think of. Downtown areas, they are frequently 90% impervious surface. You know, that's almost all water collected in storm drains and ferried off the site. A typical suburban area like Coquitlam would be in the 30 to 40% range. We generally think about streams as being compromised if there's 10% blacktop in a watershed. So, you know, what we're aiming for is 10%. You know, what we reasonably can expect to get in suburban areas is 30 to 40%. Mm-hmm. The downtown basically is a write-off, you know, when we're talking about impervious surface. I mean, it's really damage control rather than trying to reestablish anything. So what we look at is trying to minimize, you know, those transportation impacts. So we come up with things which are under the umbrella of what we call low-impact development. So it's ways of constructing roads. It's ways of constructing parking lots. Mm-hmm. So the parking lots, instead of being paved in the traditional sense, could have permeable asphalt. So what they do is in the mix of creating the asphalt, you know, they have different sizes of stones and whatever, they leave one of those out, and then that creates spaces in the asphalt for water to drain through. Mm-hmm. And we can get away with that here. You know, we don't have real frost issues, but I think in the east, that might just end up busting up roads rather. But, so, yeah. And in terms of parking lots, what people would like to see are using pavers, you know, rather than just straight blacktop. In terms of the roads, what they try to do is make them more narrow to begin with, so that creates less blacktop. And they also do something called breaking the curb. So instead of the curb being continuous and the water directed right into the storm drain, some of the water will be allowed to come off the curb and go into a grassy area that would be off to the side and be able to infiltrate that way. So those are some of the techniques that can be used to lessen the impact of transportation. But, you know, once we're talking transportation, this is urban planning, you know, and what we're trying to do is, and Vancouver is miles ahead of other cities, you know, in terms of that. I mean, you know, the livable region strategy or livable region plan, you know, the first iteration of it was back in 65, you know, and it's sort of been updated every 10 years. But 1965, I mean, that was
way
like,
ahead.
It was way ahead. So, you know, like just to decentralize Vancouver, to come up with other regional town centers like the New Westminster Quay or the Lonsdale Quay, or, you know, like what we're doing is decentralizing the core. So there's less transportation required as a result of that. The point is, it's not just the car, it's the road, right? And there's a lot of emphasis on having smaller cars and cleaner fuels. The smaller cars is good because it means fewer roads, but but the fuels issue is an air quality issue. It's not really dealing with land base so much. Not that air quality is important; it is. It has major impacts all over the place. But I think we sometimes confuse that. We figure that if we get a clean fuel, then all the problems of the car are solved. But it's not just the fuel; it's the car itself because it needs a road.
You're listening to Sustainable Futures here on CJSF 90.1 FM. This is an interview with Val Schaefer.
So going back to decentralization, is that a trend, and is that a positive thing, something that people look at as something that's desirable, to have not one big city hub that is the city, but like having different sort of built-up areas?
It is considered desirable from a number of perspectives. One perspective is the transportation perspective, because people don't have as far to drive, supposedly, to shop or to work.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the intent. But also from another perspective as well, in that it creates neighborhoods. It builds community. And once we go into that direction, then we focus more on quality of life. And that's what is missing in a lot of these debates. So, you know, there's a confusion quality between standard of living and quality of life. And people figure, oh, no, I won't have as much stuff, you know, or I won't have as much money, or, you know, they figure that their quality of life will go down, you know, when in fact it's not related at all. And in many cases, your quality of life goes down the more stuff you have, right? And so it's better if you have a stronger sense of community. That's sort of where we're going, where people want to enjoy dinners together, the whole slow food movement, you know, they want to grow food together, enjoy the food together, have it local, enjoy watching sunsets together. You know, that is low impact on the environment. It's, you know, that encourages biodiversity. That is living in harmony with nature. And decentralization, I think, is important in achieving that.
What are some latest trends? Is there anything coming up in urban ecology that's sort of an exciting new wave of thinking? What are some exciting trends that you know of?
Well, there are a few. One of the exciting trends which I see happening is the attention being given to patches of habitat and connectivity. Just the importance of providing corridors for wildlife and for plant material to move from one natural area to another. There's a lot more appreciation of the importance of those corridors, a lot more attention given to what's required in those corridors and trying to enhance them. I think another trend is the interest in backyard habitat and trying to use backyard habitat to encourage wildlife. So this is something in BC which we call naturescape, And we have a whole series of stewardship documents. Stewardship is when somebody's looking after something that doesn't belong to them, and supposedly the environment doesn't belong to you, right? And so you're a steward. And that ties into citizenship, where the citizen is becoming informed about something and then acts on that information. So you become informed about the environment and then act on that, and then that makes you an environmental citizen.
Mm-hmm.
So people are very interested in doing their part, and some people work on enhancing streams, but what is more accessible is your own backyard, or if you live in a condominium or an apartment, then your balcony.
Mm-hmm.
And just trying to do your best to provide just an incremental amount of habitat so people can do their own part. And we did one calculation to try and figure out how much backyard habitat there was in Greater Vancouver, and it's just a matter of sitting down with a calculator and coming up with an estimate about an average yard size.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that I learned from Amory Lovins, this energy efficiency guy from the 70s. You know, he'd sit down and figure if everybody switched from a 100-watt bulb to a 60-watt bulb, you know, and multiplied it by 350 million Americans, you know, what that meant.
Yeah.
But you do the same thing here with habitat. Mm-hmm. And an average backyard, well, an average yard on a home, say on a single-family dwelling in this region, is about 200 square meters. And you multiply that out by the number of single-family dwelling homes there are, and you end up with 15 Stanley Parks,
mm-hmm.
right? And you figure, well, hey, 15 Stanley Parks, that's not too shabby, you know?
Yeah.
So if we can do each our own little part, like we do with our recycling, where we each put out our humble little blue box every week, you know, mm-hmm. collectively, that translates into hundreds of thousands of tons of waste that's not going into a landfill, that's mm-hmm. that's being used again. And we can do the same with habitat, you know. We can create 15 Stanley Parks of really good quality habitat just by how we manage our yards. And there's a lot of interest in that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm seeing, you know, in terms of a change, is people wanting to do their own part. That's been going on for a while. You know, we've noticed that with stream stewardship groups, and that's been going on for over a decade. You know, really, people, even their little balconies, they want to do something. They want to get that one plant out there that's going to feed that one hummingbird that's flying through their neighborhood, you know. And,
yeah.
And
a new Hummer.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, we could change the definition of Hummer in the new city.
Yeah.
It's a bird. It's not a car.
Hummer for the 22nd century.
Yeah.
Anyway. I'm sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, so those are the trends. And I think people see nature as having an impact on their health.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a bit of education involved there so that, you know, they're not just looking at ornamental plants, they're looking at systems.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to broaden their interests from just one plant to entire systems. But it's there. And people get it. You know, they know that as long as it's somebody who's living there. You know, you need to deal with people who are living as though they're planning to stay. You know, this is the key.
Right.
This was a concept that I picked up from Rick Kuhl from Royal Rose University. And, you know, he was struggling with, you know, his rightful place in the world, you know, compared to a First Nations person who has been in this, you know, their band has been in the area for thousands of years. And he asked the question, well, what's my place? You know, where am I supposed to be?
Mm-hmm.
And he concluded that the key is, if it's a place you're planning to stay, that's your rightful place. And if you're just dealing with fly-by-night developers or people who are in it for the money and they're just trying to, you know, that they don't care what happens to the environment here, you know, because they're planning to leave, you know, you need to decide, who are you dealing with here? Is it somebody who really cares? Or are they just trying to get as much out of it as they possibly can? They're going to leave, you know, and focus your efforts on the people that really care. Or if they don't care, decide if you can make them care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make them want to stay here, and that's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
Well, I think it's important that we see cities as a place for nature as well as for people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that for cities to work, we need to figure out how that operates, you know, how people and nature live side by side or together or interrelated in some way. And that's the only way, really, that I think that the cities have any kind of future. And they certainly will be our future as our population grows and our cities grow bigger.
I guess there's a tendency to forget when you go to areas where there's less green. You tend to forget. I know it happens to me. You forget that you're outside even sometimes. It's so, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that, the future for cities is bright.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we remember nature in the city. And if we don't, then things will get worse and we'll have a lot more catching up to do mm-hmm. once we finally realize that we do need to have nature in the city.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, most of the action that happens in terms of legislation or actually doing stuff, it happens at the municipal level.
Yeah.
You know, and it happens in that council room.
Yeah.
With these elected officials. They're making the decisions. A lot of the legislation we're dealing with federally or provincially is enabling legislation. It's mm-hmm. what the municipalities choose to do with it, which mm-hmm. is important. And, so from that perspective, what happens in the cities is really what's going to change what happens in society.
So it's really a really great place to start. And to be active in changing your environment then.
Oh, definitely. And, yes. And it's very important for the future because, the projected growth for our global population, it's going to level off at somewhere between 8 and 10 billion people anywhere from the year 2040 to 2060. So we're at 6.4
already?
Right now.
Wow.
Yes. But yeah. So we've got 2 billion more people to come.
Yeah.
And the projection is almost all of those are going to be in cities. So we became an urban species is how we describe it. Around the year 2000, that's when about 50% mm-hmm. of us globally, 3 billion people, were living in cities. And the other growth that's happening, and that's globally, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, within Canada and the U.S., 80 to 85% of us live in cities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we are an urban culture, an urban society, and you know, what that culture is and what we do as a society in cities is what we're doing as humans, right?
I mean, yes.
The change happens here in the city. That's where we are and that's where demands come from. And
well, thank you very much, Val.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on, Ryan.
For spending your time. We've been speaking with Val Schaefer, who is Faculty Coordinator, Restoration of Natural Systems Program at the School of Environmental Studies in Victoria, British Columbia. All right, thank you.
Thanks, Ryan.
Okay, and now we have Kim's interview with Andrew Appleton, who worked with Evergreen. And I really am excited to hear this interview as it's a direct involvement type of thing with the environment, taking things out of the theoretical into people being directly involved with nature in the city, in parks, in school grounds. And I think this is a really, really exciting concept, and I look forward to hearing what he has to say.
With more than half of the world's population living in cities, urban areas have quickly become distinctive human habitats. While cities may serve human purposes just fine, they tend to destroy pre-existing ecosystems and drive other species out of their homes. Typically, cities have been unsustainable. Evergreen is a social and environmental organization that acknowledges the disconnect between humans and the natural world. By bringing nature back into cities, to parks, homes, and schools, Evergreen is working to reestablish a connection between city dwellers and nature. Evergreen is an organization that is applying urban ecology theories to real-world situations. To find out how this group is bringing nature back to the city, I caught up with Andrew Appleton, Manager of Stewardship and Restoration Services of the group's Vancouver branch, as he worked with the Jericho Stewardship Group to put invasive species in their place. Could you describe what Evergreen's mission is?
Well, Evergreen's a national charity, a nonprofit, and our mandate really simply is bringing nature back to the city. So we have a lot of different programs that we use to help fulfill that mandate, and we're really broad in the types of things that we can get involved in. Really, we're a social organization as well as an environmental organization. We engage people in their green space. We do that through hands-on community stewardship, through educational programs. We started off doing schoolyard naturalization, which is something that a lot of people know us best for. So working to green and naturalize inner city schools and get kids back in touch with nature right on their school properties. I work for a program called Common Grounds, which is all of our work on parks and public area space. We do plantings, invasive species removals, maintenance events, basically a lot of different community stewardship activities. And we also have a program called Home Grounds, which is natural yard and garden care, water-wise gardening, and private garden consultations as well. So we kind of work through private areas, public areas, and through school spaces.
So kind of all areas that people will come across in their everyday lives.
Right. Like I say, we're an urban organization, so we're focused on, you know, the 80% plus of Canadians that live in cities. We feel as an organization that it's, you know, that this is where green space is the most relevant to Canadians. You know, we have a reputation as a country of being, you know, wide open and full of, you know, full of green spaces and full of, you know, wilderness. But really the vast majority of us live here, and this is where we live our lives. So this is where it's the most relevant to people and, of course, affects their physical and mental well-being.
Why is it important to have nature in cities?
Well, like I mentioned, you know, it really is really, really critical for people's, you know, emotional, mental, physical well-being. I mean, green space, you know, has a practical value in the sense that it, you know, it filters pollutants from the air, it offers shade, and, you know, helps filter out toxics and deals with things like ozone and haze and those types of things. So, you know, there are physical benefits to air quality, to, you know, like I say, physical health in terms of, you know, you're not dealing with the things like heat island effect and you know, the negative consequences that you get from, you know, from concrete and paving and those types of things. But also, I mean, obviously, you know, it's really, really clear that people, you know, benefit really greatly by, in a mental and a sort of general well-being way of being out in a green space, like being engaged into a green space, being in touch with nature. I don't think it comes as a surprise to anybody now that, you know, we see really clearly that especially children and youth are becoming really disconnected from their green, you know, their green spaces from being outdoors. You know, we have a lot of kids having an awful lot of what they call screen time, you know, a lot of time in front of computers, a lot of time in front of, you know, video games and TVs. We kind of pride ourselves on being a nation of outdoorsy people, but we're, you know, very similar to the rest of North America in that, you know, we have a lot of the younger generation that are plugged into a box a lot of the time. You know, we feel really strongly that having these types of green space, you know, healthy, functioning, beneficial green spaces in the city, it's easily accessible for people, really helps helps counteract that.
Do you think that people, I mean, you just said that a lot of the young people today have a lot of screen time and there's that whole notion of nature deficit disorder.
Yeah.
Do you think there is a growing recognition of the importance of having nature in cities?
I would say so. I think that, you know, obviously there's been a groundswell of environmental consciousness to a certain extent over the last couple of years, over the last year or two. Lots more thought and action on different levels about the impact that we're having on the earth, and sort of the concept of green, you know, as a broad concept has gotten more mainstream compared to where it was 10 years ago, say. So I think that especially the younger generations, you know, they're very keen to do action to improve on what the previous generation left them. So that's always, you know, that's a real positive there. So I do see it picking up speed. I do see it picking up momentum. I think we've got a little ways to go for sure. I think a lot of people don't really have a good sense of how badly disconnected a lot of people have gotten from their green space. But I think that there's a lot of grounds for hope there.
In terms of a human relationship with nature in Vancouver, how would you describe Vancouver right now?
Well, I think obviously Vancouver, compared to the vast majority of the rest of Canada, we have an outdoorsy lifestyle. We have lots of healthy people that like to get out and get engaged into their parks and public areas. So I think that, you know, I've probably got an easier job of it than I would have in some other big cities across North America. People understand, people like to be in their green space. They understand the value of it. It's not sort of starting from point zero, trying to get people to understand the value of it. An interesting challenge that sometimes that we face working in green spaces around Vancouver is that sometimes we almost have too much of it. There are a lot of good quality parks, and we have, you know, great parks departments and people who are working hard to maintain it. And we have a challenge with urban parks, you know, maybe in Vancouver City or in a lot of the other bigger municipalities about, you know, we have areas like the North Shore Mountains and really highly naturalized areas that you can get to really quickly from the city. So a lot of people will place more of a priority on an urban park, say having a more active recreation component to it, you know, soccer fields or tennis courts or pools or those types of things. And that's not a bad thing. That's totally legitimate, but they, you know, that's something to keep in mind as well. What we find a real interest of Vancouverites is very much around the idea of locally grown food. You know, Evergreen's really interested in the idea of supporting community food initiatives, community gardening. We've been involved in Toronto to a certain extent and, you know, in a very sort of basic way here in Vancouver. But we really feel like moving into the future that, you know, Vancouverites really want to, they just really have a real appetite for that. They really want more. They want to hear more about it. So we're really kind of going to put a priority on local food and local community gardening, sort of moving into the future.
When Evergreen goes into a school yard, what kind of things do you do there? And what kind of response do you get from younger people, from kids?
Well, I think the Learning Grounds program, which is our program for schools, is really, like I say, it's really well known, really well recognized. We've been doing it for a number of years, and it's really a really well-established program. What basically is involved in the Learning Grounds program is twofold. We offer the school that applies for funding associate support, so there'll be an individual, an Evergreen associate, that will go and help them with the plant selection, the design, and help them meet their goals, so we can actually have somebody assigned to them to help them do that. And then there's also funding where the school can actually apply to the program for funding to buy the native plant material and some of the materials that they'll need to actually implement it. And then we'll help, our associate will help with the actual implementation phase of it. So it's a really great program that way. You know, there are dozens of schools in and around the Lower Mainland that participate every year. And I'm not sure what the total number is across Canada, but it's obviously lots and lots and lots. And I think, like you say, it's a national program. We have people doing that program in cities, even if we don't have a regional office there. So in other cities and towns across Canada. So I think as far as, it's really well known as a national program, and it's very well respected. So, you know, the school, obviously, we put a priority on naturalizing school spaces because kids in that age bracket spend so much time there, right? And this is what's most relevant to them. And, you know, I grew up in a not an inner city school, but in a pretty bleak, you know, sort of gray schoolyard myself. And so I can see, you know, I can see the importance in doing that.
Mm-hmm. And what an opportunity as well to teach the next generations,
right,
about how important it is to have nature.
Well, really, there's an educational facility right there on hand for them, so they can learn about native plants, they can learn about native biodiversity, they can, you know, understand, they can see and feel the effects of that naturalization right there on hand, and, you know, you don't have to sort of even go as far as, you know, the local park. You don't even have to pick them up and take them that far.
Where would you like to see Vancouver in the future?
Well, you know, I'd really like to say, you know, like I say, I think Vancouver really has a lot of energy about it already. You know, we have a lot of really enlightened people. We have a lot of people that are moving in the right direction. I think that citizens of Vancouver and just of the other municipalities really need to understand really clearly moving forward that, you know, maintenance of green spaces is a very difficult concept. I think a lot of people will see a park is created and it'll be put in place, and a lot of people will say, well, that's great. It's a park, it's protected, and, you know, there it is in perpetuity. But people really need to understand that parks don't maintain themselves. You know, we have municipal parks departments that are working extremely hard with pretty tight budgets to try and maintain the green spaces in the way that we've become accustomed to. And in a lot of cases, they can do the basics, they can do the things that are required, but a lot of the extra things that they might want to do aren't always possible for them to do. I would really like to see people, you know, all across the Lower Mainland, citizens, you know, getting engaged in their green space by going out and volunteering, finding out what's going on in their parks, going out there and doing something concrete to help their local green space. Because, like I say, I think a lot of people have this sense that things will maintain themselves, but really green spaces don't do that. If you leave them alone, they won't improve. They will gradually degrade because they are fragmented pieces of habitat. So they really do really clearly need that maintenance to be successful.
And also the invasive species as well that can kind of take over.
Well, you see, invasive species in the Lower Mainland is a massive issue for us, and it's just not really on a lot of citizens' radar screens. Not that people don't care, it's just that that people just aren't aware, I think, of the scope and the scale of the problem. When you have a lot of small fragmented green spaces, we have a lot of invasive species that have invaded into those areas. We've got a really long growing season. You know, we things grow year round here. So the invasive species, by definition, you know, they grow fast, they take over an area, and so we have to work really hard to make sure that we maintain the areas that we've got. And in a lot of parks, those invasive species could very easily take over and just become a monoculture. So it's really important that people become aware of those invasive species, understand the impact that they have. And in some cases, these are species that are deliberately introduced by people thinking that they're, you know, they're attractive. We encounter people planting things in parks because, oh, well, you know, I like the look of this, so I'm going to kind of beautify the park. Or, things like yard waste dumping, where people are, you know, removing stuff from their own yards and kind of dumping it in the green lot across the street because, well, it's green, you know, they see it as green waste or compost, so I'll just kind of put it over here and it'll break down. A lot of these invasive species, they'll just start growing again. They'll just get going and invade that green space. We'd really like to, you know, have people become more aware and more educated about that. So we've come up with resources on invasive species, a lot of the horticulturally available invasive species, and kind of put those out there, really try to promote that every opportunity we can. Because naturalization of public space in the Lower Mainland, really the two things are pretty much totally linked, you know, planting and invasive species removal. You can't really do one without the other.
What are you doing here today? We're at Jericho Park right now. You're working with the stewardship group here to maintain the park.
Yeah, the Jericho Initiative is really, it's a partnership initiative between Evergreen, the Jericho Stewardship Group, and the Vancouver Parks Board. So there's representatives down here today from all three of those organizations. And really, it's a really good example of how Evergreen works in partnership with community groups. We want our resources and our efforts to be supportive of what the community is doing. So we'll partner with the community organization to help kind of expand their goals and help build on what they want to do. The program here at Jericho happens monthly. It's on the second Sunday of every month, and happens year round. And really we switch what we do through the course of the year, but a lot of it is focused on invasive species removal. Jericho is a, unbeknownst to a lot of people, is a post-industrial site. It's been a whole bunch of different human-driven stuff over the last 120 or so years. So even though at first glance right now it seems very natural, it really actually has a lot of issues with invasive species. Like better than 50% of the plant species in the park aren't native, and so Jericho is a really good example of what I mentioned earlier of a park that, if left alone, it would not improve. It would degrade really clearly over time. So we work on a whole bunch of different invasive species during the course of the year. Today we're working on a little bit of Japanese knotweed. We've got a research project going on Japanese knotweed. And working on yellow flag irises in the pond as well. So a lot of the species have to be caught at certain times of the year because they're going to produce seeds and those types of things. So we try to get them before they produce seed and expand out.
Trying to be proactive.
Yeah, well, you try to get to it before the program expands. And then also with invasive species, you need to be sensitive to bird nesting habitat or bird nesting season. You know, the early part of the season and through the spring and the early part of the summer, you know, there's a potential for some, you know, bird species to be in, you know, some of the invasive species. So we don't, you know, we don't do wholesale removal of certain species at certain times of the years to make sure that that disturbance doesn't happen. So we'll kind of shift our focus around depending on what time of year it is, and what's flowering and what's the biggest concern at that time. So
I'll be honest, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, well,
I just thought, you know, go to a park and then remove invasive species or plants, native plants and things like that.
Right.
But it's really quite a production.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of organization.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, like I say, it is a partnership initiative. There's some really, really extremely knowledgeable people from the Jericho Stewardship Group that are down here all the time. They understand the park really, really well. There's people who've been working here for years and spend literally hundreds of hours every month working in the park. So they understand really clearly the changes over time and helping to address those. So, I mean, it's important to note that there are volunteers and organizations that do pay really close attention to what's happening in the park over time, and you know how to address that. So we really, you know, we come from a science informed background. You know, we're doing things with a scientific basis, and we base what we're doing around that. So, and you know, and that's both to be ecologically effective and also to be you know, it's a double benefit, because it's ecologically effective and then also it's positive for the volunteers, because you want to be able to go and do something that's going to have a real concrete effect. You know, obviously it doesn't make any sense to go, and some species, if you just go and pull them, they're just going to be back twice as bad next year. So you can go and whack on them all afternoon and get yourself all, you know, exhausted and tired and not really have any kind of real benefit, and then you come back a year from now and say, oh well, you know, I didn't really do anything. That's kind of depressing. So, you know, we want to be as effective as we can be.
You've mentioned the use of native plants quite a bit. Mm-hmm. What's the benefit of using native plants?
Well, Evergreen is an organization, because we're about naturalization. We pretty much use almost exclusively native plants. In most cases, it's completely native. The reason being is that that's what's most beneficial for biodiversity in that area. Obviously, native plants are what, you know, things, the native, you know, insects, animals, birds, that's what they've evolved to use. So that's what's going to give, if we plant a selection of native plants, that's what's going to give us the greatest biodiversity in that area, give us the most habitat value, which when you're dealing with small areas, confined areas, you want to introduce as much biodiversity as you can because you only have a small area to work with. In contrast, non-native species, invasive species, they're not originally from this part of the world. So are, again, you know, the opposite is true. Our insects, animals, birds haven't evolved to use those plants. So really nothing eats them, nothing really uses them for habitat. They really have very, very limited habitat value. And at the same time, they're also pushing out and excluding native species from that area. So you have a corresponding loss in biodiversity. Like I mentioned, you know, we have to, when we want to plant native species, a lot of cases we have to contend with the invasive species first. You know, you have to have a plan on how you're going to deal with the invasive species, because if you plant a big swath of native species and the whole thing gets overrun by knotweed or something like that a couple of years later, then that's not effective. So you need to really think about what you're doing.
Thanks so much for your input and your very interesting answers to my questions.
Ah, you're welcome. My pleasure.
And now for this week's Streeters. And Kim will be asking people on the street about sustainable cities.
Can you define what a sustainable city looks like to you?
A sustainable city, I think, would encompass a community in which they work together in order to create sustainable methods, whatever those may be.
What city do you live in right now?
Vancouver.
And on a scale of 1 to 10, how sustainable is Vancouver? 1 being the least sustainable, 10 being the most sustainable it could be.
I'm pretty biased because I've just come from China. After spending 2 years in China, I would place Vancouver quite high on the level of sustainability. I would place Vancouver at a 7.
What would make it a 10?
First off, improving public transit. I use it all the time and it's not very accessible late at night when I come home from work. Having more opportunities for local farms and local produce being accessible in more places.
What do you think is the most pressing environmental issue facing Vancouver right now?
For me, because the way Vancouver spread and Vancouver's set up, I think the biggest issue right now is commuting and clogging up our roads. That's something that I think is more able to be controlled through government policy, not through $100 checks.
Do you think that cities can actually be sustainable, or do you think that they are inherently unsustainable?
I think the way the global economy is right now, they're unsustainable, and they will always be unsustainable. There would have to be an entirely different shift in the way that we run our world for something to become completely sustainable. And we're just pushing towards a place where cities are even less sustainable by themselves, in the sense that they can't grow their own food and produce their own stuff. They're exporting and importing everything. For me, I don't see it becoming sustainable, and I unfortunately see it going the opposite way.
Can you define what a sustainable city means to you?
A sustainable city means a city that is energy independent and has green technology and stuff like that.
What city do you live in?
I live in Richmond, yeah.
And on a scale of 1 to 10, how sustainable do you think that city is?
I'll give it probably a 7.5, like it has good transportation.
What could make it a 10?
I think that a 10 would be to have like more bicycle lanes and to have more buses running at peak hours, making public transit more affordable and like accessible to people so they'll get out of their cars.
So what does a sustainable city look like to you?
For sure, the one that have no pollution. Just like Vancouver, actually. Yeah, I like Vancouver.
What city do you live in?
I live in Vancouver, downtown.
How sustainable do you think Vancouver is on a scale of 1 to 10?
I'd say 7. The transportation is good already, but there's too many cars in downtown and there's not many people riding a bike or whatever. So there's still many people driving cars. It's still a lot of pollution.
Do you think that cities can actually be sustainable?
The city, for sure, if the people cooperate.
What would a sustainable city look like in your eyes?
I guess eventually for cars that don't use fuel, and also buildings and everything would be more green, using alternatives so that we don't use as much electricity and things like that.
What city do you live in?
Coquitlam.
And on a scale of 1 to 10, how sustainable do you think it is?
Oh, 2.
Define what a sustainable city looks like to you.
I think a sustainable city basically utilizes its space really well, for instance, for transportation or just whatever's already been put in place. So if it's mainly agricultural, they need to make sure that they upkeep that area instead of just going for development only.
What city do you live in right now?
I currently reside in Delta.
And on a scale of 1 to 10, how sustainable do you think Delta is?
I would have to say a 7 right now.
Why is that?
That's because they are pretty good about some things, such as making use of the space. However, they are developing a lot of agricultural space for other intents and purposes, and also because we have issues with greenhouses and not using environmentally friendly practices.
What do you think would make your city more sustainable?
Making better use of the land. So if it is in a freeze for farmland, that it should be reevaluated based on that and not just given to developers for expansion.
Do you think that cities can actually be sustainable?
I think it depends on the city, and I think it's how it's actually been planned. So for some cities that are just being mainly developed, I think they have a better chance of being able to utilize better sustainability practices, whereas for other cities, I think it's going to be a little more problematic. So for instance, downtown with the congestion.
And what do you think the most pressing environmental issue facing your city is right now?
Currently, I would say the greenhouses, definitely, and just the fact of, like I said, not using environmentally sound practices, so the glow of the greenhouses and what it's doing to the surrounding environment.
And here is your environmental news.
Ellesmere Island in the Canadian Arctic is a little bit smaller now after a large chunk of ice broke free this week. The 20 square kilometer chunk of ice broke off the Ward Hunt Ice Shelf, the largest ice shelf surrounding Ellesmere Island. Researchers predicted a large section of the Ward Hunt Shelf would break away soon. On a recent Arctic expedition, scientists found new cracks in the ice that stretched for more than 16 kilometers. The Arctic may be breaking up, but increasingly more species are calling the North their home. Rare European birds are becoming climate change migrants, according to a study by researchers at Durham University and Cambridge University and the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. The researchers found that 42 rare bird species have been moving northward since 1980. Species most commonly found in southern Europe are now being seen in Britain, and birds typically found in Britain are now being found in northern Europe. Birds can easily seek cooler temperatures because they can fly. They are therefore typically the first species to adapt to climate change. And the state of California will try to force the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency into action by suing them for not regulating industrial greenhouse gas emissions. California Attorney General Jerry Brown said that the EPA has wantonly ignored its duty to control greenhouse gas emissions from ships, aircraft, construction, and agricultural equipment. This is the third environmental lawsuit California has been a part of this year. In April, 18 states, including California, sued the EPA for not limiting greenhouse gas emissions from new cars and trucks. And in May, California joined 12 other states in a lawsuit against the EPA for not regulating ozone pollution enough. Well, if they don't win this latest lawsuit, you can bet they'll be back. I'm sorry, I just couldn't help myself. That has been this week's edition of your environmental news update. So that wraps up today's show, Ryan. We had two great interviews, one from Val Schaefer and the other from Andrew Appleton of Evergreen. And just to kind of bring the two interviews together, there were a couple of interesting points that both Val and Andrew spoke about, one of them being food.
Having food grown in the city, being something that's good for city living, really brings down the transportation. The interaction with food is also very important. Yeah, I find that very good to hear.
Yeah, well, I thought that it was really interesting how Andrew identified that Vancouverites have this thing about food and growing their own food and knowing where their food comes from and what's being put into their food. It's a really strong trend in Vancouver right now. And, you know, it's just really interesting that both of them brought up how growing food in cities can help reconnect people to the environment and to a more sustainable way of life.
Mm-hmm. I think living in cement environments, you tend to forget what's underneath it.
Good point. So actually coming up on next week's show, we are going to be talking about food. And we have an interview with the Vancouver Farmers Market.
Yes, I'm really excited to have those interviews. There's a lot of really great farmers markets in the greater Vancouver area.
Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Sustainable Futures. I'm Kim Tate.
And I'm Ryan Fletcher. And we are wishing you
a sustainable future. You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. We are also available on the internet at www.cjsf.ca. And if you want any information, you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.